Hi, my name is Rafi and I'm the host of Coaching This Podcast. If I only doubled down on my EQ skills as soon as I started my management career, I would have made a much bigger difference to my teams. EQ is a better management success predictor than IQ, and we need to put more time and effort into developing those skills. I started my journey in my early 30s and there is no looking back for me. My life can be split into two stages, before and after I started actively working on my emotion intelligence skills, especially the self-awareness part of it. Catherine and Chris, my today's guests, played an important role in helping me learning and developing those skills. As EQ coaches, they are working with leaders all over the world, helping them cultivating leadership with the EQ at its heart. Few topics that we discussed today: how to build trust from the scratch, why embracing vulnerability is a strength, and Kat shared with us why she shouldn't be promoted into her first management role at the age of 22 and why her deputy was a better choice. We also discussed empathy, one of the harder skills to develop, and Chris shared three questions that will help everyone be more empathetic. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, Catherine Delaporte and Chris Mack.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, absolutely. So good to be here.
Fantastic. Before we go ahead, could you just quickly mention how you are making the difference in the world with the EQ as a coach? What exactly do you do? How are you spending most of your time helping leaders get better with emotional intelligence?
Catherine, I'll let you go first.
Oh, you're so polite. You know, it's really interesting what you just said. The story that you just shared, Raf, is not dissimilar to my own story. And probably the story of many people who are new to management, or any kind of team leadership. So the difference that I am really interested in making is just really thinking about how people are at heart adaptable. Mm-hmm. As humans, we adapt. I'm an anthropologist. That's my undergraduate degree. And I think a lot of people have forgotten just how they can adapt, how agile they are. Mm-hmm. So the conversations that I like to have with people is very much around adaptability, agility, and resilience. Mm-hmm. And that is the work that I'm primarily doing now with my clients, building resilient, agile, adaptable teams and individuals.
Wow. And you, Chris?
Oh, Chris.
Yeah. So, you know, for me, it's always been about, how do I help people be energized, be engaged, and feel that they are enabled to bring their best selves to work? And so I don't know if either one of you know this, actually, but, you know, 4 years ago, I started KeyMax Solutions. And so that was really my primary focus. But a year ago, I pivoted and I started working for the Achieve Institute. And the reason why I did that was because I was able to take what I was doing on a one-on-one basis and be able mm-hmm. to scale that in a much larger way. And so mm-hmm. for me, it was like, okay, how can I take what I know is so powerful with emotional intelligence and then parlay that into something that really equates into high performance and scale that and maybe even across an enterprise. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if you guys need that, but I have pivoted and that's really my focus. So it's still about helping people mm-hmm. energized, engaged, and able to bring their best selves, but doing that not just one-on-one, but scaling that in larger ways.
Yeah. Wow. This is going to make this episode so good. Now we've got two strengths all around EQ. So I'm so excited about it. And I thought about the first question that I'll ask you. And because we live in such a challenging times, 2020 wasn't the easiest one for us. 2021 didn't start much better. And mm-hmm. so I'm curious how being an EQ coach helped you to get through those tough and challenging times.
Go ahead, Catherine. We'll just keep the same cadence.
You know what? I've just written a post about this. It was actually specifically about the topic of workplace choirs, which I'm really fascinated by, building communities through choirs, through singing. And one of the reasons that workplace choirs are so incredibly powerful and impactful when it comes to mental health and well-being is because they lift your spirit, this mm-hmm. idea of spirit and hope, giving mm-hmm. you a sense of hope and optimism. And I just reflected on that. And Chris, I can't remember whether or not you use the EQI MHS system. Yep. Yeah, same. So you'll know from the report outs that one of the really interesting parts of the reports from this particular assessment is you get to focus on and have a conversation with your clients about happiness and contentment. Mm-hmm. And there are four things to think about when it comes to the mental health and well-being of individuals and teams. Mm-hmm. One of those is optimism. Mm-hmm. The second is our human relationships. Mm-hmm. These are things that sustain us. It's not just hope, it's also about belonging. And then the two other pieces of the puzzle that kind of relate back directly to your question, Raf, about something you mentioned about emotional self-awareness, just being aware, frankly, that one has emotions, that one can have emotions at work, and that you can use these emotions, and they're very, very powerful way of influencing both oneself and others. Mm. But it's about self-regard. I love myself, warts and all. And second of all, it's about I have a sense of purpose in life. Mm-hmm. So what is really interesting about these things, I mean, and Chris and I have a very similar background. We spent many years in sales and business mm-hmm. development roles before we got into coaching. And so as a salesperson, you know, you learn about how to sell to somebody. So you need to understand basic human psychology in order to be an effective salesperson. There's so much, Chris and I have had so many interesting conversations around mm-hmm. this piece, how to build trust from scratch with somebody who's mm-hmm. never met you before. So it's kind of almost biblical. If you think about what makes somebody tick? What is the core motivation of a human? Mm-hmm. And it is love. Now, in business language, no one likes using the word love. So we more generically talk about trust. But trust is a psychological state. And it involves neurochemicals, neurotransmitters. Mm-hmm. So there's hope, belonging, love, hope, trust. You know, this is the stuff of life, and it's almost like at some point we forgot all about what sustains humans mm-hmm. when it comes to workplace performance, and suddenly a door has been opened to us again, and we mm-hmm. are presented with this incredible opportunity through some of the great writers of the last sort of 5-10 years. Daniel Goleman obviously is one of them, and there's a whole load more who have finally reopened the door to the fact that actually what motivates a human being to be the best version of themselves is all about emotions and emotional mm-hmm. self-awareness.
Yes.
Please add your amazing wisdom.
I just want to touch on that very shortly, because I'm keep on sharing this, and it resonates that story with what you just mentioned. Because in 2006 I joined Hard Rock Cafe, and it was my first working place in my life, and I felt like I belong. In previous to that, I would just be an employee and just wouldn't even understand what leadership is. I'm also born and raised in Poland. At the time we belonged to Soviet country, that Soviet bloc. So empathy, aware, self-awareness, it wouldn't be even conversation. It was just not even a thing to discuss. Like, I've learned the concept and the words as an adult from the books, if I'm honest with you, because instinctively somehow we know them. But when you say that the trust is, it's all about the love and the belonging, when I feel like I belong, I said, this is amazing. Like, I want to be part of it. But more importantly, whatever I do, the person to my right and to my left will feel exactly the same thing. I don't know yet how, but I'll figure it out. And that's from that point onwards, I just keep on working and figuring out how can I do that. And Chris, you mentioned scaling that one-on-one. For me, how do I scale? This podcast is scaling, helping other managers recreate the same feeling that I had back in 2006 for the first time, like I belong, I feel safe, and like I mattered, and I could contribute to people around me, regardless of my social status, regardless of my background, where I'm coming from, my even current capabilities and job roles, more importantly, like, you know, the hierarchy level. It wasn't important at all. Was me, Raf, who could contribute, and people supported me. So, wow, what you just mentioned, it just literally, it's a pivot point in my life.
Yeah, one thing that I would add that, you know, when Catherine was speaking and talking about the essence of kind of psychological safety is that if we think back about, you know, when this pandemic started, of course, the globe was experiencing this pandemic, but we didn't all experience it in the same way. Mm-hmm. So meaning that some people may have had challenges with worrying about loved ones and their safety and their risk. Some people may have been worrying about their children learning and how they were going to manage that. Some people may have been worrying about financial insecurity and food insecurity. So there are lots of different challenges that were going on. And that was something that we absolutely, you know, at the Achieve Institute, when we were helping the clients that we were working with, was helping them understand, again, that empathy piece. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how can we create that psychological safety, meet people where they are, help them understand, like, we're here for you. We understand that your challenges may be different than mine and versus, you know, your colleague. And that this, it, going back to the optimism piece also that you brought up, this has been a long thing that we've all been enduring for a while now. There was a lot of uncertainty, but that reminder of this is for now, it's not forever, I think mm-hmm. is a really important thing when you're trying to maintain perspective and good mental health so that we can show up and be our best selves at work. And also just knowing that, you know, it's not helpful to continue to compare how we work today with how we worked pre-COVID. Because mm-hmm. that's not a fair historical comparison, right? So yep. much of what we're doing is virtual and we're having to create new ways of doing things. So being really forgiving and being open and flexible to new ways of doing things is really, really critical when you're having to create new, because the options for how you used to show up at work maybe look very, very different.
Yeah. So what I like to do is just add a little small spin into the conversation. I always imagine myself, there's loads of managers like I was right at the beginning of my management career, that I have this passion, this fire in my belly. I want to change the world. I want to be the different. I want to make that difference. But how do I do that if I don't have the mentor-like leaders around me? Right? So let's just pretend, almost for the rest of the show, that that's me again back in the management position. And you've mentioned, how do we build this trust from the scratch? What would you advise me to build that trust from scratch with my team that I just took over and I've just been promoted as a manager? Let me just use this as the storytelling for the rest of the episode.
Well, Raf, that's a really interesting question. And what I would say is there is a degree of introspection that mm-hmm. is required in order to transition to become a great people manager. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of goes back to, it's not actually trusting others, it's trusting yourself. Mm. That for me personally is where trust needs to start, which is about, look, self-love. Mm-hmm. If you don't love yourself first mm-hmm. and trust yourself first, you are not going to be able to offer others all of the amazing attributes and capabilities that Chris has mentioned in regard to empathy and listening and understanding. Mm-hmm. You just will not be able to do it. And this is, I think, the biggest opportunity for anyone even considering becoming a manager, is to ask themselves the question, why do I want to be a manager? Mm-hmm. It is not an easy job. It is not an easy path to take. It is a path of sacrifice, actually.
Mm-hmm. Why do I want to lead people and human beings? Because I believe the answer to that question often is automatic, and because I need more money. And I think that's mm-hmm. when you become your manager. Mm-hmm. You know, most of the time, huge amount of promotions comes from this position. And who wouldn't say no to more money if you have a second child coming up? Or, you know, like myself, when I was in England, I had to bring my family back to UK. I said, look, for a year, I'm going to the UK on my own. And I need a year to settle things up to bring you back in here, my son and my wife. So I need more money. I will do anything that is needed. I work 7 days a week, etc. But I want to just go back to that point about love and trust. And I want to think about to my early years as a manager. I would trust myself because I'm a former athlete. I would trust my capabilities, my resilience, my grit, all those strong capabilities, if you will, like, you know, one spectrum probably of EQ, but I would never even consider to have a conversation with myself, to love myself. Again, it really comes back through the reality that I was raised in, and that just wouldn't be a part of the conversation. So I wouldn't even consider that. So where do I start? So I'm the only individual who trusts my companies. I can do it. I have this can attitude. I trust that I can do it. I'll persevere. I'll, you know, I always think to myself, I'm a wrestler. I'm built to endure, period. Whatever comes at me, I'm built to endure. But how do I start loving myself in that process? Because it's so important. I agree with you. But I don't know where to start if I don't have that mentor around me, somebody who says, hey, this is how you do that.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that a big piece of that is really goes along with Brené Brown's work around vulnerability and really embracing vulnerability and looking that at that as a strength, that is not a weakness. And so starting with like loving the skin you're in and, you know, loving yourself flaws and all, and you know, getting back to Catherine's point about, you know, why would you want to lead people in the first place? You have to understand that leading is service, and you want to be a good leader that people will follow and respect and trust and get the best out of your people. Then that has to start from a place of genuine service, where you're setting yourself up for failure and you're setting your team up for frustration. So I agree with that, but I do think that, again, that piece of vulnerability, like, you know, it's so important for leaders to be genuine and authentic. And part of that is being able to say, like, I don't need to be the smartest person in the room all the time. It's okay if I'm unfamiliar with something, if I don't have all the answers, or also to say, I screwed up, I made a mistake. Asking for other people's ideas, that's the strength of vulnerability and the strength of good leadership. So I don't know, you know, if you want to add anything to that, Catherine, but that's my take on it.
No, I'm as you're talking, I just was inwardly grimacing at, frankly, the choice that my organization made to make me a manager at 22. I mean, we didn't have individual contributor tracks at that point, particularly. That's the track I should have been put on. I honestly can tell you that I don't think I was ready for man management. I didn't really like people. I mean, it sounds very strange to say that. Obviously, I do like people, but not in the way that people-oriented people, the genuine, you know, people who just are, you know, fired up by others. I, at that point in my career, was incredibly selfish, highly competitive. I was an incredibly effective salesperson. I was not. And it was actually that capability, that grit, that drive, that's why they gave me the management role. I was not ready for that management role, and I was very fortunate to have a line manager who had those human characteristics, those human connection characteristics, and he dealt with a lot of the stuff that really I probably should have been dealing with, and he just let me get on with selling stuff. I was the wrong choice. My deputy at the time was the right choice. Luckily, she was an incredibly, you know, egoless, I would say, person. And, you know, she was an amazing kind of yin to my yang. But yeah, I think, Chris, I'm interested in your and Raph. I think this happens all the time.
I think that is a very common scenario where people are elevated to leadership positions based on their performance as an individual contributor, which is a completely different skill set than it takes to lead and serve others. Yeah. And so we see that time and time again. And, you know, the sad thing, in my opinion, is that we set people up for failure because we're promoting them based on a different skill set than it is needed to succeed in the job of leadership. And often these poor souls don't get effective leadership training for the first 10 years of their leadership experience. So imagine, you know, the experience that we are creating for them and for their direct reports. That's not a good one.
It's a classic Peter's principle, is it? We promote people because they're best at what they do right now. My background is hospitality, and I started in the kitchen, then moved out front. And again, if you were the best chef on the busiest section, you're the manager. The promotion is for you, right? And I think going back to this terminology and language that we're using, if we ask ourselves, you know, is Catherine ready to be a manager or is Catherine ready to lead people? That already changes your entire thinking about, like, should she be promoted? Should we have the conversation with her? Or the deputy person is a better person to lead people, right? So rather than not only necessarily asking ourselves, am I ready or do I want to be managed? Do I want to lead people? You've mentioned it's a service. It absolutely is. Then we should change the language, the terminology, and just asking ourselves the questions. We have this team meeting or management meeting. You know, is Ruff ready to lead the team of 10 people?
Yeah.
And you're straight away focusing on different attributes, I believe. Mm-hmm. And you know, am I ready to, for me, right at the beginning of my my career, yes, you know, I was ready to handle the highest pressure possible. Absolutely. Was I ready to lead people? I don't think I was. Mm-hmm. In fact, I wasn't, because I tried to apply everything that I learned as an athlete for 14 years into working environment, and which is actually a nice transition to self-awareness, something that's didn't exist for me as well. And I learned the lesson the hard way. What I've learned as an athlete worked for me and drove me forward and made me unique at a point. I tried to implement it with others and I couldn't understand. I was puzzled. Why on earth you're not seeing the world the way I do? Why you're not as ambitious as I am, as resilient as I am? Why you are handling pressure so differently to me? It wouldn't even occur to me that I'm imposing myself wrongly on my people and I'm judging them through my own standards, right? And that's what we tend to do. We judge people through our own point of view rather than who they are. So let's just have a small conversation around self-awareness. What would you suggest to me or to anyone out there? How can you become a bit more self-aware person? Because for me personally, it's one of the most important skills that we can have and master in our lives. I don't think we can ever master it. It's one that we should always work on, I believe.
Catherine.
You know what? It sounds very simple, but it's about learning to sit with one's thoughts and emotions. It's the ability to go away from the rest of the world, from other people, and sit often in uncomfortable silence, listening to the voices inside our head and the emotions that go alongside those thoughts.
Yeah, I would add it's being able to step outside of yourself, right? And be that observer, as if you were watching somebody else, but you're actually looking at yourself. And as Catherine mentioned, the thoughts, so what's playing on auto loop in your mind, how is that impacting how you are connecting with others, how you are interpreting what's happening around you, how it's affecting your decision-making, et cetera. And also tuning into those physiological reactions that always accompany emotions, whether we realize it or not. Mm-hmm. And when we can get really good at that observation and understanding, then we can also start to look at what's triggering our emotions. Mm-hmm. How is that impacting our reaction or response? And then if we don't like it, what would we do differently if we could press that redo button? And that's how you, I don't think we, like you said, Raph, ever really master it. I think we're always a work in progress with self-awareness, but we absolutely can make really great gains if we're focused on that, and we have to practice it, practice. So.
Yes, I agree with you. And you've mentioned, Catherine, that listen to our own thoughts and where they go. I think for many people, it might sound cliche or bizarre, but what I would say, and right before the episode went live, we spoke with Chris about what's happening right now, and I haven't really listened to too much news and read, but what I do tend to do is to use internet as my tool to practice my self-awareness. If I read a statement or comment, something that is polar opposite to what I stand and believe, what I tend to do is approach this conversation with idea of, like, I'm going to see what my instinctual reaction will be like, almost like I'm going to enter this conversation knowing that I'll be triggered, knowing that I get a little bit agitated about it, but I want to catch myself happening and then digesting, like, why exactly did it do? Like, what was my first thought as soon as I read this comment or this point? So I can practice it without causing harm in the real life, if you will, because I'd rather practice it on a social forum and just not comment, but just, you know, being observant of my reaction than doing it with my kids, right? So starting paying attention to what we really think based on each situation, whether it's an email that you read, or newsflash that you see or whatever that is, it gives you an opportunity to really catch yourself in the moment and think, where were your thoughts going? Your first 5-6 words. That's all you need to do. Catch yourself your first 6 words, because they, to me, you know, it's like YouTube or cookies. You just press one thing and then your mind just goes with it, follows it. That's how I view things. Like if my first few sentences follow a certain path, you just stay on it and just keep on going and keep on going. And it's so hard and bring it all back and stay present. You're already invested emotionally into the whole process.
Do you know what? That's really interesting what you were just saying, Raph. I really like that idea. And it brings to mind probably one of the greatest things that I got out of my coaching training was learning how the human brain works. Which, interestingly enough, Google's new manager program, which they've built off the back of, I think, you know, thousands and thousands of observations of people at Google. One of the things that they tackle on that one-day program is the basics of amygdala hijack, you know, the chimp bit of your brain, the logical bit of your brain. This is, it's basic stuff, but in your manager training, Chris, or did you ever get to see, you know, a little bit about, learn about the brain and the fact that survival mechanism in the brain is so powerful and, to your point, will take over. And if you're not aware of it, you literally, you don't know what's going on. And therefore, if you don't know what's going on, how can you even attempt to control what is going on?
Yeah.
So that there was a book that was recommended to us at the time, The Chimp Paradox. And I mean, there's a number of books like them. But I think that very basic, how does the human brain work? And frankly, a stark reminder that we are animals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, that part of the brain that processes emotions has not evolved a whole lot. And so sometimes our emotions are more than what we need for the circumstances today. And that's because they're designed to help us really survive. But sometimes they get in the way of today's environment. And so getting back to that amygdala hijack and what's triggering that, and understanding those patterns so that the next time you encounter a similar trigger, you're able to have a better response so that you're not so overly charged from an emotional perspective.
Hmm. So. It reminds me of one of my toughest lessons as a manager, but also as a father. I realized by, you know, like you mentioned, Catherine, by going through sitting down with yourself and thinking what you think and really look at your perspective and what you've said, Chris, as well. Watch yourself from the side, how you respond and when. I did this exercise because I've been doing so good with not overreacting with my employees, lashing out or getting angry for nearly a year or so. I was so proud. Like, yeah, I've got it. I've nailed it. And in the space of a month, I just went on a tangent twice or three times. And I was like, this is not me. This is not what I stand for. This is not what I work towards. But it happened. Like, and I need to claim responsibility, because there were circumstances that I could say, yeah, it's the CEO decisions, it's the circumstance. It wasn't. And I started to think, like, what was it? And I realized, what was it that I respond to behaviors of somebody who's like 18, 19, 20 years old differently to you? So if somebody shows me lack of respect, or behave in a way that I read as a lack of respect and questioning me, and you that in that age gap of 18, 19, 21, I just get like this. And with you, if you have the same behavior, I realized I'm cool, I'm fine. And I was like, okay, so what do I do next, Raph? If you have a difficult conversation with somebody who is at a young age, you already know that I'm more likely to get triggered. And it's not on them, it's on me, it's how I responded. But I knew, at least by figuring out that this is a scenario that happens, it has increases the likelihood for me to behave in a way that I don't want to.
Right.
And then eventually I work my ways through dismantling this trigger and no longer exist.
Yeah.
But this whole process of stepping down and thinking, like, how did I behave? What was around? And I was really curious, like, when, how, what happened in the morning? What happened in the afternoon? Who was he? Who was she? And I just started painting this picture. And I was like, every single time when it happens, this is what cues. And I realized it's also happening with my older son, because he tends to have this face expression, especially in the past, that says, I don't care what you're talking about. Like, I don't claim any responsibility for it. It wasn't the case that he was that way. He just face expression for me looked like, you're not interested in me. what I'm saying, and you're quite frankly disrespectful to me. That was the story in my head. And I was like, that's the connection. So I need to now work on it so it doesn't happen again in the future.
I think it's really helpful, and it helps us to kind of be very kind to ourselves when that happens, because nobody feels good when they have an amygdala hijack, right? So it's really helpful to understand that our brains don't decipher between a physical threat and a social threat. A threat is a threat, and it can send us into survival mode. And so, especially from a workplace context, you can start to notice, once you understand this, what sends you into survival mode, which can result in you either becoming, you know, more aggressive than you'd like to be, so confrontational, or shutting down, right? Withdrawing. Mm. When you put, I love to explain that to people, because when you put that in like a either a one-on-one or even a team environment, and you go, oh my gosh, now I know what's putting me in survival mode and how I'm reacting, but I also can see how I've done that to others, right? Maybe there was a specific subject that I brought up, or it was the way I said something that triggered that person to go into survival mode, which, you know, is either a confrontation or a withdrawal. And it gets really interesting. And then we can start to have good conversations, because now we can bring empathy and understanding to the scenario.
I always use the example of showing people that we can't really distinguish the difference between different type of threat to us by think about yourself when you're watching a horror movie. Intellectually, you know that threat has nothing to do with your security, and yet the bodily response and how you respond to it is exactly as if you were there. So it's not like what you think about it, it's just how your body responds. And it does the same thing in other scenarios, whether it's real or not. Like, better safe than sorry, right? From survival perspective, I'll just trigger it, and if it doesn't happen, well, you're still alive, so I won, right? So yeah, you're absolutely right. You mentioned empathy here, and this is something it's a huge part of being a great leader. And wow, where would I start to being a more empathetic person? Because I have to admit, and I've said it many times, I wasn't. I think instinctively we know what it means and how it is, but when you're showing up in the real life, it's difficult. So for me as an athlete, it was difficult to be empathetic with others, like struggle. Perhaps somebody is like you, Katrina, you know, a top salesperson, and just it's difficult to empathize with others who don't deliver the same type of results or handling stressful situations just as much as we do because, well, because of many things. So where would I start bringing more empathy into my team? What would you say to me?
So I wondered if it's good to define empathy, because I think people misunderstand the word empathy, because there's empathy and then there's compassion and there's lots of different. So I think the way that certainly I have learned about empathy is the ability to walk in someone else's shoes, the ability to see things from somebody else's perspective. That is really hard to do.
Yes.
Great, Chris?
One of the hardest skills when it comes to emotional intelligence.
There's a lot of talk about empathy in organizations, and I would say a very, very few people are getting it right.
Along those lines, when I'm trying to help people understand why it's so hard and how we can practice better empathy. And I want to say that I believe this comes from Stephen Covey, so I didn't come up with this, but I use this all the time, is asking yourself these three questions. So what if I knew only what they knew? What if I had experienced only what they had experienced? And the third one is, how would that change my perspective? Because to what Catherine said, it's really hard because we have our own opinions, we have our own experience, we have our own knowledge base that we're drawing from, and it gets in the way of us walking in somebody else's shoes or truly understanding their perspective. We can ask ourselves those questions. We can now put that on the back burner and really focus on understanding without judgment.
This idea, Chris, this is so interesting. Listen. Because again, this often gets rolled up. We must listen to understand. I mean, again, it sounds amazing. I remember sitting at the back of the classroom in my first coaching class and just thinking, there's no way that I can sit quietly listening. listening to understand.
Right.
Our first coaching exercise was literally, and it was so awkward, sitting opposite, at, you know, one of our classmates and just looking into the other person's eyes.
Oh, yeah. Saying,
it's
Chris,
hard.
Sorry to disturb you, but when you said your three questions, mm-hmm. it makes so much sense. And let me just explain to those who are listening right now why they're so powerful and helping, being so empathetic. Because just today I had a conversation with my wife and mm-hmm. I said, we as a man, we don't really appreciate and understand what does it take to upbring a child the same way that you, a woman, does. And I was like, I'm thinking, for me, man, we're trying to hide behind because I'm going to work. I'm working 10 hours a day. Well, let's mm-hmm. just have a second child. I'll take extra hours. And I'm helping you for this 3 hours a day. And it's like, what we are missing is those three questions that you've mentioned. Yes, I'm coming from home after 8 hours of work. I'm contributing to the household because I'm helping you for those 3 hours or 2 hours. Absolutely right. But ask yourself that question. What if I had the same experience like you, that only? What if I only knew what you do? And I don't know how it is to spend 8 hours with a demanding child who's mm-hmm. seeking my attention. What yeah. we do see is like, well, I'm working so hard and I'm helping you. And all you do is just with a kid. So I'm doing two things and doing one thing, kind of like sort of, just to translate it on a quick sort of scale. I'm not saying that all the parents do that. We had this conversation about all the parents and we've seen this pattern around with our friends and families. And I said, I always appreciate what you do because I have no clue what it takes. So I have no right to judge and say my job is harder than yours because I've never done yours.
Yeah. I think empathy is one of those power skills that can turn an adversarial conversation or relationship into a collaborative one. But, mm-hmm. but like both of you, even though of course, I think I do better with it now. It's not a skill that's easy for me either, especially when I was younger. Oh my gosh, I'm like embarrassed to even think about, you know, just how I'd be like, get over it, you know? Who cares? This is what we're doing. And I can laugh at it now, but I mean, this was a skill I definitely had to work at. And, you know, sometimes people will ask questions, well, how does personality relate to emotional intelligence? And this is one of those areas of emotional intelligence that I do think our personality traits interact with these skills and can help us to be able to use these skills more easily and more often, or can make it more of a struggle. And so in my case, I do think that, you know, I'm a direct communicator. I'm one of the more, even though people won't realize it, I'm more of a bold personality type. And I do think that makes a more challenge for me to use empathy, but that, again, it's a skill. So we can absolutely get better with intention and practice and focus. And so I've come a long way, but I know in my heart that there's more growth that needs to happen there.
Love it. I think it's the same thing with the self-awareness. We continuously have to work on it. And there are moments when we're on our low or high. Yeah. So we got to focus on it. One thing that really helped me with it as well is to change the narrative in my mind when I was judgmental of other people, because I was judging what they were doing versus I would or wouldn't do.
Yeah.
What I did at some point is I changed my script and I said, Rob, what you're doing is you're not judging what they're doing. You're judging their happiness. Mm. You're judging what makes them happy. You're judging what's a source of sadness. Mm-hmm. And I've been sad. I've been happy. So mm-hmm. rather than changing, focusing what you're doing on that activity itself, I'm just focusing on the emotions, like who I am to judge your happiness, what makes you happy. Just because I didn't do it and I don't feel happy or joyful by doing so, this means that you do. Like, so I don't have right to judge your happiness because there are things that I do that makes me happy that others would even consider or look at me like, mm-hmm. who the heck does that, right? So I think for me personally, what helped me is to change that narrative in my mind, focusing on, I'm not going to judge your happiness, not what you do, but I'm not going to judge your happiness because it clearly makes you happy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Or, you know, I even think about, especially in the US, you know, the huge political divide over everything these days, and what a difference our world would be if people practiced empathy. And again, instead of judging, right, truly trying to understand what is their experience been? What if I only knew what they knew? What if I had only experienced what they experienced? You could still have a difference of opinion, but there would be some common understanding that would be such a strong place to start a conversation from, mm-hmm. versus people just allowing emotions to cause them to assume bad intentions. And when we assume bad intentions, we label people as bad people.
Yeah.
And we have to find a way to create that bridge and that common understanding, because I can tell you, you know, both of you know that well, Catherine definitely knows, and Roth, we were talking about that before she got on, you know, that I wrote a book and I interviewed women from all over the world. And, you know, what I found was that no matter your religious beliefs, your socioeconomic status, your country of origin, your political beliefs, et cetera, we are so much more alike than we are different. Mm-hmm. And there's so much at our core that we have in common. And gosh, what if we could just find a way to build from there rather than looking at what differentiates us?
Well, that's Adri, to one of my questions that I meant to ask is that multicultural aspect of our teams and businesses, and having you, you know, from across the pond, and me and Catherine living in the UK, I'm Polish myself. So let's just discuss a little bit more that EQ and that factor that is, you know, those multicultural teams, and we're all from different parts of the world. What's your experience with working with people and helping bring that EQ to workplace in the context of being from different place? From all over the world and having different type of upbringings and sets of core values and beliefs. Now, for me, for Polish people, especially, you know, when I was raised, it's all about being professional. Mm-hmm. Above all, like, even at the workplace, you refer to your manager through sir, right? In the UK, I was confused when the folks from India would keep on referring to me as sir, and like 20, 30 years older than me. And he just, Sir Raf. I'm like, whoa, this is, you know, this is strange, but I need to accept that this is how you were raised and that's how you communicate your habits. So rather than focusing on this is uncomfortable for me, well, this is important for you, yeah, and I need to honor it and celebrate it, right? Mm-hmm. So let's just have a little bit of conversation around that multicultural aspect.
Catherine, I'll let you go first.
You know what? I think travel and meeting people from different cultural backgrounds is incredibly important because it actually allows us to grow the empathy muscle. Mm-hmm. We realize just how narrow our own existence is, and to Chris's earlier point, how much we actually have in common with people around the world. Certainly my work life, I spent a lot of my work life in America and Germany, France, and no doubt that experience. I mean, people do talk about CQ, right? They talk about cultural quotient. Mm-hmm. If you think about a lot of people who do MBAs, even people in large corporates now who, you know, in the past, the way to get to the top of businesses, you had to go and do your stint abroad. That was a really, really important part of getting the promotion onto the exec team. So absolutely, very, very important to build that understanding, cross-cultural understanding. You know, just the fact that, you know, we live in a new, highly nuanced world. Mm. Things are not black and white.
Yeah.
Everything is gray.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I've worked with a number, gosh, probably at this point, thousands of people, you know, where I've debriefed their results from their EQI assessment. And I think context is so, so important so that, you know, sometimes people will say, well, I'm German and, you know, we don't express our emotions culturally. Like, that's not something that we do, you know, in the workplace. And so I do think context is really, really important, but also helping people understand, again, that empathy piece. Well, who are you interacting with and what are those norms? So that, yes, like I get where you're coming from, the context of how you were raised and you know, where your office resides right now might be in Germany, but you're interacting with people from the US who do express a lot of emotion, you know, in the workplace. So how can we leverage these skills to help you show up stronger and be a more effective communicator, build stronger relationships? So, again, context and empathy in that perspective when we're talking about multicultural workplace, I think is important.
Mm. May I just bring something in here? A thought that came to me, Chris, when you were speaking, which is when we travel to other countries or we mix with people from different cultural language backgrounds, we have to work harder to understand. Mm-hmm. So we tend to make less assumptions about those people. And this is the trick, because of course, when we interact with people from our own background, particularly, you know, particularly our own gender, for example, women talking to women, men talking to women, you don't have to work as hard. So whereas challenging our assumptions, I mean, this is the basis of really good coaching. And frankly, the ability to shift one's perspective is about challenging our assumptions. We don't have to do that. We don't have to work that hard. If we keep the a very narrow social sphere.
Yeah.
So anyway, yes.
Yeah, totally agree.
There was a point when I stepped down from being like a senior manager to lower ranks in order to build my own business, to give myself a little bit more time. And one of the junior managers asked me once, like, Raf, when you see us making those early silly mistakes, stupid mistake, do you judge us? Do you think this is stupid? This is not how it's done. And I said, I no longer do. And it's important to say that I'm no longer do. And what helped me to overcome that is to, rather than focusing what you're doing, is starting with what led you to behave that way. Who was your previous manager? What's your history as an employee with your previous mentors or managers that actually nobody took care of you and you're behaving in a certain way? And you can expand it on, so what's your cultural background? So you behave in a certain way. You mentioned Germans wouldn't express emotions. Polish, same thing. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to understand that and don't force us. Well, our value is to be transparent and you have to be. Well, this is 35 years of being raised, not being transparent. Right. What's going on here? Like, how would you like me to do that? Like, this is the lifetime journey almost, and you're asking me to just comply with your values. I understand the intention is great and important. I don't think we all disagree, whatever you're from, because they are so universal. It's just I'm not able to do it overnight, even over a month or year even. If you sit down on the annual progress, you know, appraisal time, right? Every year now is the time to do that. I can't even do that within a year. So you need to understand that what you're asking me is to change my lifetime habits and behaviors. So we need to celebrate and accept.
I think that's a really great point. And even bringing into that self-awareness our familial role models and how they express emotions and how that impacts how we do it today. I think that's always a very interesting conversation as well. And I will find when, in particular, when it's men that I'm talking to that aren't comfortable expressing emotions, when we get into the conversation, we start peeling back the layers of the onion, it's often because there are cultural familial norms that basically said it wasn't okay. And, you know, what I always try to help people understand is, again, like, to be really kind and loving to yourself, not to judge yourself so harshly, and that, you know, it's important to recognize who we are and how we were shaped, but these are skills we can get better at them. Those influences that tell little boys from a very young age, you know, that they can't cry and they can't show emotion, we're telling them to deny their humanness. And, you know, that's a problem. So, again, I think, you know, going back to Brené Brown and her work, I love her work because there is something for everybody there. And so usually when, especially if I'm talking to a male who's having trouble expressing emotions, I will always recommend her work, because there's always in her books a chapter for men on vulnerability and expressing emotion. And I think it's just an important place to bring to the self-awareness piece of things.
Sure. So the way I embraced my expressing emotion, the two things were really important in my own process. Number one, I had a mentor around me. Kieran is actually commenting here right now. So hi, Kieran. Thanks for joining in. He always gave me the space and asked questions around my emotions. I could express myself to someone in a safe environment. I was asked those questions. But if you wouldn't ask those questions, I wouldn't answer them to myself in the first place. But when I decided to do that, I used my athlete-like mentality. And I was like, this is a challenge. I'll just go from one skill to another. I decided to make transparency as my core value and live through it. And that helped me tremendously. But not everyone has that athlete-like mindset that goes, you know what? I haven't been doing it. I'll go straight into the kind of the older end of the spectrum. You know, I'm smoking for 20 years. Tomorrow I stop, right? Not everyone can do that. Sometimes it's a gradual process. Only the gradual process for someone who doesn't have that mentor-like leader around and doesn't have that safe space in the working environment, but still understands it and knows it and wants to embrace that journey and break those decades-long habits of expressing their emotions, where would we start?
Catherine, you want to go first?
You know, I think, you know, it's quite interesting. There's there are some cultures that have a huge emotional vocabulary. Mm-hmm. And there are other cultures. I'm afraid the United Kingdom has not got such a wide vocabulary. I mean, it can come down to just the words that we learn as children to express ourselves. I mean, if you think about the word love, I mean, love means a whole gazillion things. It's one word. And yet in other cultures, Spanish, you know, Italian, you've got multiple words for love. You know, there's different types of love. Mm. So I think actually building an emotional vocabulary is a good place to start, mm-hmm. which is quite an intellectual exercise, actually, but just actually sort of listening, reading, mm-hmm. and of course the travel piece. So that would be a good place to start. I have to say that probably for me personally, I'm not suggesting youngsters in their 20s do this, but possibly the first opportunity that I had to really express myself, bearing in mind that most of my managers in the first 15 years of my life were men. Mm-hmm. One of them was a gay man. He was absolutely fantastic and incredibly demonstrative, but was having children. That's what switched my brain. Mm-hmm. It did. Mm-hmm. And I was really able to be vulnerable with my children. That was game changer for me.
It's interesting about the emotional vocabulary piece, because with my work with people from different countries, I have heard that as a barrier, especially if English isn't their first language and now they're working with people in the US. It's like, well, I don't have a command of the English language. How can I express myself well? So I think that's a great point, going back to that multicultural piece, is really learning the various words that you can use to express yourself. But I would also say, I think, again, emotional expression has got to start with self-awareness. If we are not even in tune with what you're experiencing internally, what's that internal temperature gauge, how then can you express it? So I would go back to self-awareness first, work on that first. When you're starting to express yourself, for me, I'm somebody who I have to process, and it takes me a little bit of time. So writing for me is how I am able to understand, especially if it's a complex, emotionally charged situation, what it is that I'm feeling. And so I will write without judgment and then put it away and come back to it for really process and understanding. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's a great way to kind of start expressing that emotion, putting it out on paper.
You know what? It's like three people in this conversation and the three different ways of doing so, which shows me there is no one way, there is no D way. You just have to experiment and see. For me, I turn into my competitive side and I treat things as a challenge and turn in my second value, which is curiosity. What did I felt? Mm-hmm. And if I can't name it, why can't? What do I do to find out? So English is not my first language. If I can't express it, where do I find the answers? Who do I ask? What's the difference in between one? And I remember I was asking the difference between sympathy and empathy. I was like, what do you mean the difference? Like, is there a difference?
Yeah.
So, you know, that vocabulary needs to be expanded. But there are different ways. And you've mentioned, Catherine, doing with your kids at home. Mm-hmm. I always advise around my feedback coaching business to start practicing at home. It's not easy to start changing your feedback habits at work all of a sudden, because one, people will look at you like, why have changed so much? And it feels awkward. It feels uncomfortable. Even with sharing a positive feedback more meaningful and more frequently at work, feels strange and bizarre to some. Start doing it at home with those that you love the most. It's the safest place to practice, I believe.
Yeah.
And then you create those habits. You create this vocabulary that you need. And you expand your palette, right? You're no longer painting with three colors. Now you have a palette that you can bring to work and start using a lot more frequently and comfortably with yourself, I would say, as well.
Yeah, agree.
So what I am curious to wrap up this episode is to find out what was your best coach-like leader that you worked for or with in your life, and what made that person so amazing?
Go ahead, Catherine.
You know what? There's probably two people that I learnt a huge amount from. The first one, first person, actually, I spoke to him recently. He's sort of semi-retired now, but his name is Martin Leach, and he was my first boss, first proper boss out of university. And he was, you know, hugely inspiring, compassionate human being. And he at the time, at a time when this is like early 1990s, where, you know, obviously we're talking about diversity and inclusion. He honestly, if you had seen the team that he hired, this was a small business, a magazine publishing company, and he hired so many interesting people from so many different backgrounds, different ages, gay people, straight people, black people, white people. Honestly, this was just this incredible multicultural organization. And boy, did we do well. It was, you know, kind of case study for why hire a diverse workforce. So he was, really instrumental and very hands-on, but huge heart, really amazing person. The other person who I have huge, and in fact we've become great friends, is a guy called Tim Finn. So interestingly, both men. And what I love about Tim is just he listens. He's the most amazing listener. No judgment. You know, he's a bit of a quiet genius. Again, you know, he builds trust very easily, great counselor, hugely intelligent, really, really great brain. And yeah, it was an absolute joy to work with both of those people. I learned so much and they let me fly.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Be jealous now. Mm. And Chris?
Yeah. I've worked for a lot of great people, but the one that comes to mind is a guy named Stuart Taylor, who I worked for at Merck. And what stood out to me was his genuine interest in people and how he could meet them where they were, help them expand their capacity so that they were able to enjoy their jobs and be top performers. And it was just amazing to watch him work with people and the confidence that he helped them gain. And again, what, you know, he was there, he was truly that coach, cheering you on, pushing you to the edge of your capacity, but also just, again, that heart of gold and very empathic and just such a solid person. So, yeah.
Wow. Incredible. This is fantastic. I love listening to these stories, those leaders, and there are traits that always are the same and different people are different. And what I get from those questions when I ask is sometimes all it takes is to focus on one skill and double down and become so known for it. You've mentioned Finn was a really good listener, just sits there and listens. Like, imagine if you just said, like, I'm going to be that person that I'll just listen. And I spent a few years of developing it, but you have to really dedicate yourself. And that just one skill only makes such a huge difference in people's lives. And years later, we remember it and we paying forward and we want to teach others to be that people and strive to become like one. It's incredible. Wow. So thank you very much, ladies, for this conversation. Evelyn, so much. I'm going to have so much fun editing this episode because so many golden nuggets. The episode, guys, will be out in several weeks. And thank you very much for tuning in into this live conversation. There are some cool comments as well. I'll get back, guys, to you right at the end of it and respond to those as well, guys. So thank you very much for tuning in and until the next time. Okay. Thank you, ladies.
Thank you.